morning, everyone. My name's John Quinn. Welcome to the September 21st Air Quality Control Advisory Council meeting. We'll start by introducing council members that are here and council members emeritus that are here that might be called into service with this kind of attendance. So if we start with that, it's good. Please go ahead.
Okay, I'm Sania Amr, and I'm at University of Maryland School of Medicine.
Jonathan Kays, University of Maryland Extension.
Ross Salowitz, University of Maryland.
John Green, EA Engineering, representing the American Institute of Chemical Engineers.
Julia Levy, and I'm representing, I think, the Children's Environmental Health Advisory Council.
I still mess up today.
Apparently, I screwed up last time.
Todd Abert, Air Director, MPD.
Lauren Gerritsen, ex-member of this group, pediatrician.
Hussein Vahid, MD.
Carolyn Jones, MD.
Joshua Shodende, MD.
I'm Paul Stevens, University of Maryland, and I'm with Mr. Salowitz today.
Kathleen Wainis, MDE.
Jed Miller, MDE.
Dwayne King, MDE.
Chelsea Ritchie, the Recruiting Manufacturers Association.
Ryan Plummer, MDE.
Megan Albrecht, MDE.
Davis Medic, Sierra Club.
Tom Weiss, Raven Tower.
Katie Knack, MDE.
Diane Franks, MDE.
Todd Chase, Gordon Fine Black.
Dave Kramer, NRG.
Randy Mosier,
MD. We have more council members come in, and maybe if other people come in, we might. Did I miss somebody?
On the phone.
Oh, who's on the phone, please?
From Lita Mack, representing the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments.
Hey, Lita Hunt.
Who is that?
I got Lita, but who else was after that?
Tina Hunt from PPG Product Stewardship.
Kaushik Patel from Benjamin Moore.
Larry Case Camp, AFL-CIO.
Dave Darling, American Coatings Association.
Carol, did you get all the names on the phone?
I think so.
Second.
Yes, there was someone from Benjamin Moore. If you could just repeat your name.
Yes, it's Kaushik, K-A-U-S-H-I-K. Last name is Patel, P-A-T-E-L.
Thank you. And then, what was it?
PPG.
PPG, your name, please.
Tina Hunt, H-U-N-T.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody we missed that hasn't spoken up yet on the phone? Well, thanks for joining by phone. We sure appreciate your involvement. Everyone should have a copy of the agenda in their hands, and there's a couple new items on the agenda that aren't normally on. We've been very fortunate to have great people over the last decade or so on the Air Quality Control Advisory Council. And sadly, we're losing a couple of members. We're getting great people to take their place, but so we're going to come back to that. And then there was a request to talk about how we schedule meetings for ACAC. Then we'll go into our normal kind of business. Any questions on the agenda? So talking about appreciation, we've had some really great people on our council. And we've been cohesive, and people have been very dedicated to this council, and I absolutely appreciate it. I think it's, I'm on a bunch of councils and conference heads and all that stuff, and this is the group that we can count on to come to meetings, have a really good discussion, and I think we help make better policy, and I hope everyone agrees. But there are life changes and it's dynamic and people move on. And I'd like to just quickly mention that Kip Keenan, who's a longtime council member and a really good friend, I've known him since the late 70s. and that's a long time. And he's a family man. He's very good at his business. He was Northrop Grumman's international vice president of environmental for the last 2 years, and he still found time to participate fully in this group. Now, he wasn't able to make it today, and the reason I wanted to mention his name, if you could, everyone could take a moment, and I view it as a moment of prayer, but people could just view it as a moment of reflection. His in-laws are very ill. He was planning on coming today, but his father-in-law had a major setback in his illness. So I'm just going to take a moment to people reflect on that, or however they want like to deal with it. Luckily, he's coming to a future meeting, so we can make a fuss over him. Thank you. So another person, and we're lucky enough to have him here today, is Dr. Garrison to my left here. You've been absolutely a joy. Every day has been fun. Every time I deal with you, you just have a nature, and I don't know if cute's the right word, but you have a cute little smile at all times when we have a conversation. So that's how I do it. I'm just telling how it is. So if you have a pediatrician, what kind of smile do you want them to have? Okay?
I want a guy with a bow tie.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, he does his Marcus Welby thing sometimes, but then sometimes he jumps in and takes us where we're supposed to be. What is the outcome you want? We're talking about health. Who are the most vulnerable? Who do we care about most? And he brings us back to that several times a year, and we're going to miss you so, so much. And you've been such an addition, and we're a little bit angry you're leaving, but we understand there's already so much devotion you can give us. And I think Tad wanted to say something also.
Sure. I've been doing this council a long time, and the current council we have is absolutely the best council we've had in the history of the council. Dr. Garrison was a key person in starting that. And more than anything, I think that he always stayed focused on the mission, you know, air pollution, public health protection. And every time he said, now this may be a stupid question, I would wince because I knew where it was going. So we really do appreciate the way you've made this council work, your focus on public health protection, and just the way you handled the job. It was great. We really, really do appreciate everything you've been done. And personally, I'd like to thank you. So it's been a great, great year. So.
So in appreciation, we have a certificate from the state. It's signed by the secretary, and I'm going to present it to you and give you an envelope to put it in.
Needless to say, this is not a group that was in any way that I had been engaged in this kind of thing before in my career. And I got to it by being a member of the Children's Environmental Health and Protection Advisory Committee, and then was appointed to this as a representative. Now Julian's doing it, and we appreciate that. But this has been a new experience for me, and I must say, I have been proud to be a Marylander, to have a committee that is as scientifically grounded and focused on public health as this committee has. It's been a delight for me to be here. And I have appreciated the leadership very much and the friendship. So, thank you. Thank you all.
What bonded our friendship together is after the meetings, we used to go to Paul F. Johnny's and get really greasy food and friendship.
While you were talking about health, right?
Yeah. No, we did. Yes.
Other people's health. That's the key.
That's the key.
So, as a small token of appreciation from the council, this is a small token, and it may not be compatible with your panache, but you.
You want me to open it?
I do, and it's. So what kind of wrapping paper do you use? It's congratulations, goodbye, all that. But in his case, I look for, on one side of the funny papers that I use to wrap it, is Charlie Brown. And the other is Family Circle.
And that's it. Oh, yeah. Oh, my. Maybe I'm still an adolescent. Oh, isn't that pretty? Oh, yes. I do wear these.
Oh, maybe John is going to have to teach you how to tie it.
Oh, no. This is wonderful. This is a miracle collection. Yes, I know what that is. Wonderful. Oh, yeah. I have... That's very nice. Thank you very much.
Any other comments? Thoughts?
Sorry, guys.
Yes, we're getting back. Well, that was the most important business to me.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, thanks. So we have two new council members, and I was distracted as you came in. And if you could just let people know so people on the phone know who's here.
Sarah Tomlinson. Cindy Parker.
Thanks for coming. Next up on the agenda is approval of meeting minutes from the last time. They are in. You should all have a copy. They were sent out. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to look at them. Yes, Dr. Sal.
Whoever put these minutes together did a fantastic job, in my opinion. But there's one typo. Paul Pinsky's name is spelled wrong.
We can't have that.
Yeah. On page 5, I believe it's P-I-N-S-K-Y.
We can correct that.
Thank you.
Great correction.
I mean, someone could Google this and, you know, not find it.
Spell check doesn't catch that.
No, I mean, you know, but it's on the web and all that.
Any other suggested changes? I'll entertain a motion if someone has one.
So moved.
Do we have a second? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Great. Now, next up, just... Tad, do you have anything to open the meeting?
Well, just a real quick update, which is good news. And I thought that maybe Dr. Erickson's departure was linked to this. It appears that the state is heading towards full attainment of the 75 ppbozone standard. We got about 6 days left in the summer, so I don't want to hedge my bets yet. But ozone levels have again been very low. Looks like all three areas, Baltimore, Washington, and Philadelphia, that we're part of, will be measuring levels that are meeting the 75 ppb ozone standard. So that's good news. On October 1st, however, EPA will, under quarter deadline, come out with a tighter standard. So we will quickly bump back into non-attainment. But the fact that we continue to lower ozone levels and that we're on track to become attainment for the current standard is all good news. And the council should feel like they've had a big role in that, because all the regulatory actions we adopt are a big part of why those ozone levels continue to go down. So that's probably the other piece I would mention is that we have a very intense process going on right now over the state's Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act. 2015 legislation set up a commission. And we've been previewing sort of the status of where we are. The law requires a 25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. We've now just done all the number crunching, and it appears that we are on track to achieve that 25% reduction by 2020, and to do it in a way so it has a positive impact on the state's economy and a positive impact on jobs. In October, MDE owes a formal status report to the legislature. So We will probably be at our next meeting briefing MIACAC on sort of that piece. Again, a lot of the regulatory actions that you all have taken, had a role in, everything from Reggie to the Clean Cars program, have had a big role in helping us to achieve that goal. So probably the two big things going on.
Can I bring in here?
Yeah.
We spend an awful lot of time talking about PPMs, all this kind of thing here, but as was mentioned by Tad in the beginning when he was speaking about me, that the real measure that you're after is health, children's health, or health, children's health, if you're at the bias like I am. And, you know, it's just been remarkable that in the last few months we've got one of the best studies out on children's pulmonary function in Los Angeles. Los Angeles, of course, because of the formation of the mountains around it, concentrates air pollution pollutants, and they've had to work very hard at it for a long time. And they've got really good medical measurements now showing the improvement in children's health because of what they've done over the years. It takes a long time to get an effect and get it, but it's what you want to see, but it's so hard to do that measure, and they have been able to get that, those numbers. These are not insignificant studies. I can't remember the numbers of kids in this study, but it was enough to be significant, and so all this effort has been, I think we can expect to be playing out in health kids.
Thank you very much. One more announcement I'd like to make is I don't think, for a lot of reasons, and Dr. Garrison's absence, I don't think the future ACACs are going to be quite as comprehensive as the past ones have been, because there's a person in the room that has had a lot to do with the work that went into preparation of materials for ACAC, and I point to Diane Franks. This may very well be her very last ACAC meeting. Diane Franks has announced her retirement, and I just want to make sure people recognize all the hard work. How many years have you been with MDE?
34
years. What a long career. This was a small.
I was going to actually do a little thing when she's going to do her last presentation as part of today's meeting, so I'll say something then.
All right. So now we're up to action. Oh, no, we have an item on the agenda that a council member wanted us to put on. So this is for the council. I want to be clear on meeting scheduling and using your time wisely. And I know sometimes we get frustrated. For instance, the last meeting, there were so many people here. When we schedule a meeting, we really try to take into account how much time it'll take and what we're going to deal with. We don't want to say it's a four-hour meeting and then bring you in for an hour and a half meeting. So maybe we've erred the wrong way. But give us input on, I think when we got the stable council going is when we established four meetings a year at 8:15 in the morning. That's how we got stability to this group. And we scheduled them ahead of time. Not when they were needed, we scheduled them ahead of time. And then the department graciously thinks about what they need and schedules it to the council's desire. It doesn't work the other way around. That's how it used to work. So the council's the department's been real great about accommodating us and our time, realizing how important. A lot of you people do a lot of really important things, and we want your input. So we schedule it. We do four times a year. We announce them a year ahead of time, and then the department adapts. But sometimes we have to schedule an extra meeting, and that's what happened at the last meeting. And it was a little bit disruptive because we thought it might be a short thing. We thought there was going to be agreement between parties, and people would come in, and it would be relatively short. And then you remember, the room was full. It takes a lot of time. So that's frustrating, and I apologize. That's my job to manage that a little bit better. We started to know close to the meeting time that there'd be a lot of people here. So we should let you know that. And if Carolyn or Randy or Tad, whoever helps me, I would say Diane, because it would get done if I asked Diane, but she won't be here. If you could help remind me that this might be a little bit different than the agenda we set out. I'd like to hear from several people at least on how we can do a better job setting the meetings up, managing the time, not overstating what we need from you, but not understating it like we have a couple times. Anybody have thoughts on a better meeting scheduling process? Satisfaction is an okay response.
Oh, you know, I think the thing would be just, again, I'm relatively new to this, but maybe just at the last meeting, heads up in the beginning that they acknowledge that this meeting might very well go over in, you know, an hour or so, instead of just kind of the time rolls on. And, you know, I was impressed the fact that you got through in the amount of time you did, to be honest with you.
We got through.
That you, well, yeah, but you were directing it. But just some indication, so because people can probably text or whatever, make some arrangements, but it's nice knowing, you know, at 9 in the morning that's going to be the case rather than all of a sudden it's 11:30 and you're like, well, you know.
Yeah, and what I added to that is 2 or 3 days before, we should have sent you a note, this is likely to go over based on
we
the
have to know that. Yeah.
I mean, I will say bad news early so that you know it's going to take longer, but also I think we have a real responsibility to the public. We had a lot of participation from both sides last time, which is, I think, good, even if it takes long. And I think you did a masterful job of helping them condense their comments.
Yeah.
So that we got all of the comments, and yet it wasn't people being repetitive. But I do think we're in the public domain, and sometimes it's going to take longer than we expect, and I think that's good, because we have public participation. We're concerned about air pollution. So sometimes, in spite of the best planning, it takes longer than you expect.
So I'm new to the council, but my concern about the last meeting was not that there were so many people wanting to say something. I thought that was great, but I also thought that was an indication that there are a lot of very strong feelings about what we were discussing, and then we didn't have time to actually discuss. There was this big sort of mandate that we had to make a decision without having enough time to actually talk about it and deliberate among ourselves. So that was the part that I felt uncomfortable with, that there was this, you have to decide today, we heard all this testimony, okay, now decide, and that didn't feel right.
And if, so, and maybe my view's wrong, I just want to put out, they had been meeting for a year and a half, there were stakeholder groups along the way, and remember, we're an advisory group to the secretary, and then there's the legitimate public process with public notice and comment. I'm not saying I disagree with you. If you could think of a way we could get to that, but that would be more the stakeholder group before they came to us to have deliberation. But if this is my commitment to you, if you need more time to decide, and we can get a majority to agree with you, then we just hold the thing, and then the department has the right to move ahead without our consent. Or they can wait until they get our consent. So that's our job as the council. If we need more time, no matter what Mr. Avern says, we can hold things and take the time to deliberate that we need to. So we should have that. Please be very vocal with that need if you think we're there in the future.
I just want to second what Cindy said. My feeling is that we were very rushed at the end and didn't really have a chance to engage with each other about our feelings. And it was a very unusual time for the council, because very often our votes are unanimous or maybe just one abstention. Here we actually had true disagreement about the outcome, and I don't like the option of just not voting, so therefore MDE does what it wants to do. What I would prefer to do is in the future, if we, you know, we have a sense going in whether something's controversial or not, and if it is controversial, we should put in the agenda a good half an hour for the council to discuss and deliberate. That's kind of hardwired in and not be railroaded into taking a quick vote because we ran out of time. Like, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. I don't think you ever run out of time. I think you don't plan to manage your time properly. And so I think in the future when something controversial comes up, we just need to hardwire into the schedule deliberation time, whatever that means.
And if I might make a suggestion, I think that's a great idea, and that's why we're having this conversation, because we hardwired in a topic about scheduling on our agenda. You're right. So when you get the agenda, if you can comment back, I would like to add something. Feel free to add things to the agenda, and we'll try to adapt to that. If you think that's a good process approach.
Well, the other, I mean, there was discussion at the end. I mean, maybe another way to do that is to say that there's some agreement that even after a long meeting like that, that there's going to be 20 or 30 minutes, you're going to have 20, 30 minutes of discussion. Because I think the way a lot of us felt, well, you know, I'm late, I got to get out of here. And if, you know, you agree on that as a group, and then you take 30 minutes, and then you vote.
And if someone needs to leave, they can just leave a written vote.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't be forced to vote because somebody had to leave. Either.
I agree. But then I think if you schedule the half hour, 20 minutes at the end, that's what time you use, and then you take a vote.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But do you agree on that? That you say then you're at ease to discuss and not like, well, no one else has raised their hand, so I guess we're ready to vote.
So, and the way I think about that in terms of process is we start at 8:15. We usually end up starting at 8:20 or 8:25, which is fine. That's what's built into the 8:15 rather than the 8:30. I don't want to start at 9. And then we should make a break at 11:30 for those meetings that would just be to discuss the final vote. No matter what happens, if all those people in the room, we might have to amend that. But generally speaking, 11:30 to 12 might be that time frame when we have something controversial. So I suggest that when you get the agenda, if you want to make sure that exists on the schedule, that someone asks for it. Is that a good process way to move forward?
Yeah.
But because yeah, you don't want the run-on that goes on forever that you never get done to.
Well, the other thing about that, John, may be the fact that the department is the best able to make that assessment, because maybe stakeholder processes, and Ted, correct me if I'm wrong, run into the 11th hour because the discussions are intense and deep, and there are multiple meetings, and it may not be clear until near the end of that process that it's going to remain controversial.
I don't quite understand what you said there.
Well, if I understood what John was saying, he was suggesting that council members request a block of time to deliberate things that they feel are going to be controversial. But I'm saying the department's input into what's going to be controversial is probably important too, because they're often involved in the
And remember, they suggest the original agenda, so
right.
That's a good suggestion. As you send out that original agenda, if you think that you want to have that there's going to be a need for a longer debate, we need to build in time to the draft again. And usually I have interface on the agenda. It's probably my you know, ahead of time. So it's probably my slight that I didn't think to put this in earlier in the process.
Ted, when did you learn that there was going to be a room full of people?
Pretty much that morning. And I was going to add in from a department's perspective, we agree with everything that's being discussed around the table. We actually take great pride in the way that the council usually has such meaningful input into what we do. It was an unusual meeting. We apologize it took so long, but we got a lot of public input. So I do think it was an unusual meeting, and our goal for the future will be to make sure we have that engagement with the council in the way they think it needs to happen. So it was an unusual meeting, though. A lot of factors made it unusual.
If we know in advance, would there ever be an opportunity just to have more of a public meeting, and then in advance of our meeting, just to address that one issue?
So, if I might, you're kind of new. I don't know how many of the mailings you got before. For the big stakeholder groups, for the last decade, I would say, the council has been invited to the stakeholder groups.
Okay.
So they can participate as council members, and they can state their status as council members at those meetings.
Okay.
And I think some of these things are deep. This is what I've done for 30 years. And some of them are too deep for me to get my hands all the way around. And so that stakeholder process, sometimes the way you learn it, you see people's point of view. And I'm not sure this is the deliberative part of the process at ACAC. Not that we don't want the input. It's just if someone meets our next rule, how long have we been working on the AIM coatings rule? The variations for
20 years.
I think more than 20. Good suggestion. So I'll summarize this is MD will contemplate controversy and potential need for closed council discussions at the end of meetings and suggested in future agendas. But we should feel when we get our draft agenda, we almost always get it a week ahead of time, 10 days ahead of time. Please comment back to the sender, which is usually Randy or Carolyn these days. If it makes sense, that's what we'll do. Thank you. Sorry for all that administrative stuff. Going to next, we have Eddie Durant up for the architectural and industrial maintenance code.
John kind of mentioned to Dr. Anderson how long we've been working on the AIMOL. For a good long time, I guess back to 2001. We adopted it in 2004, and it's based on the Ozone Transport Commission model for architectural and industrial codes. But those new members in the audience and those that just here that aren't familiar with the Ozone Transport Commission, it's a multi-state group made up of 12 states, Maryland, and Sugar, Boston District of Columbia, and what they do is they develop strategies for ground level ozone. And this regulation applies to the sale and manufacture of architectural and industrial maintenance coatings for use and application in the state of Maryland. Three main points is that this regulation, it regulates the VOC content in coatings. This is the most important point. The second is it has content and container label requirements. If you've ever been to the hardware store and you bought paint, you've probably seen the back of it, seen all the information. That's the type of information that I'm talking about. There's also compliance and regulatory requirements that manufacturers have to comply with. One thing I want to mention is that since that time, if you recently went out to the hardware store and you bought paint for the paint your house, or you had some contractor come in and you paint your house or do your floor or you work anywhere or you move to a new house that's been painted. It's a 99.99% probability that those paintings were subject to this regulation. This brings us to the new regulation. It's based on phase two of the OTC model rule, which was developed in member states. Again, I kind of explained what the OTC is. This has been a process going on for the last, I guess, 2 years. And this model was based on suggested control measures from California, or more specifically, CAR. And what they do is they evaluate the feasibility of different coatings based on surveys, feedback, information gotten from manufacturers, et cetera. And this is being submitted as part of our SIP, our state implementation plan for VOC. As part of the Clean Act, you're required to submit a attainment plan for NATS, which is the National Air Ambient Air Quality Standard. And one thing I want to emphasize is that this regulation is 85-90%. It's very similar to the previous regulation. All it does is it revises some of the content limits of coatings that are more stringent. It changes up some of the definitions of some of the coatings. And some of the standards and requirements in the regulation itself are a little bit more stringent than the current regulation. One thing that John and members of the ACAC Council like to ask of the department is, what about the stakeholder process? Well, it's been an involved process. We've been OTC as part of, being part of OTC, we've worked on this rule since 2011 in conjunction with stakeholders. We held a stakeholder meeting a couple months ago back in April. Part of the stakeholder process includes associations, manufacturers, retailers, contractors. Some of them I see here right now, some of them I know on the phone. So I mentioned before that since this regulation is 85-90% reflects the previous regulation, and there are very little changes to it, that there were no subsequent comments. One thing I do want to mention about the stakeholder process is that it's an ongoing process. It doesn't stop here with the ACAC meeting. It doesn't stop with the public hearing. It's an ongoing thing. There are some regulations even today we still get phone calls, we still get emails about, and we want it to be a thorough process where we get input from everybody. It's not only associations, manufacturers, trade associations, we also get comments back from the customer public. Now, this is the second question that John and the members of the council always ask us about, which is what is going on in other states. You can see most of the states here are white, and then these states would fall under the national EPA, the national rule. This was implemented in 1998. You see some of the color states here. I talked about the OTC. You see the green color states in the Northeast. Most of those states either have phase one or developing, like Maryland, phase two of the regulations. There are some in the Midwest that have phase one. I believe Ohio is one of the states that are developing phase two. California, they have 34 air districts, but only 22 of them have some type of phase one or phase two. Most of the most stringent regulations for phase two would probably be along the big cities, which is like San Francisco, Oakland, and Los Angeles. You also see Utah, which is the red state. They just a couple months ago promulgated phase two of the regulation. And one thing I'm interested in about Utah is that they're the only state to promulgate a regulation outside of any group or multi-group effort. So they did that in a visit. And one thing I want to point out is that as more states implement these rules, more manufacturers are developing products that have low VOCs. And eventually you'll see it nationwide. You see more and more say we're making some coatings for this state that some coatings at that state that meet this VOC limit, and whereas in others they don't meet it. They eventually just make coatings that comply, that just have a general low VOC. Now, this regulation itself, as of January 1st, 2007, it applies for any architectural and industrial maintenance coating that is for sale, that is sold, that is supplied, that is manufactured for use in the state of Maryland. Now, this does not apply to architectural coatings that are offered for sale, manufactured, or for use, or for shipment to other manufacturers outside the state. We do have an instance where we do have one stakeholder which they do make coatings and paints, but they don't sell it in the state of Maryland. They ship it outside the state of Maryland. This also does not apply to aerosol coatings and does not apply to coatings sold in volumes of 1 liter or less. And you see the different exclusions there, which are the different coatings categories, two component product. Now, keep in mind what I just pointed out as far as the one liter dimension, because this does not apply to the bundling of containers 1 liter or less and coatings that are marketed and packaged where it implies that multi-container monorail mass can be complied with one container. And what this is to prevent that one-bit exemption from being used to circumvent the regulation. Now, I kind of mentioned that the previous regulation and this proposed regulation are pretty similar, but there are some differences here. As you can see here, this new regulation, certain coding categories have been eliminated for a variety of factors. Some of them are that the definitions or the recommended usage of these codings it's been changed. So a lot of these codings have been eliminated or even moved to existing or new categories. What I can give you is flow codings. It's been moved to industrial maintenance codings. Some of the sanding sealers, varnishes, clear brush and lacquers. It's now a new category called wood coating. We now have new codings that have been added to the regulation. I kind of mentioned that because of usage, based on usage and definitions, some codings have been eliminated and moved to different categories. We saw that in some instances, some codings could be moved out of certain categories and become its own separate category. Roofing codings used to be metallic codings. You saw in the previous slide where we had waterproof and concrete masonry sealers. They're now just concrete masonry sealers. And this slide is pretty self-explanatory. Some of the codings have been revised where the current limits have been revised and is now lower. All this is just a result of manufacturers now making coatings that have lower VOC. Most restrictive limit, I mentioned some of the requirements and standards are the same as in the previous regulation. Most restrictive limit, this is the same as we have in our current regulation. You'll find it in the regulations of states that have any regulation. You can find it in the national rule itself. What it says is an architectural coating meets the definition or recommended use of one or more category, then the most restrictive limit will apply. Only caveat is that it doesn't apply to certain coatings, which are, I have some of them here, they're probably a little bit more listed here. And during the first rule, when we developed it, and even during school, this was because we got feedback from industry, and there are certain categories that certain codes that are used, and they have certain specifications that it's very hard that they reformulated to work as it's intended to do. I can tell you one of them is for nuclear codings. We had feedback from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that told us, well, we need this coding to be a certain spec. The other one is that certain that up in New York State, they have the locks with Niagara Falls and use an immersion coating. They needed it to be a certain spec, and they recommended us not to change that coating. Now, just to give you an example, because even though it's stated in most regulations, a lot of people don't get it. Let's say we have floor coating, which is 100 grams per liter, and then a driveway sealer that is 50 grams per liter. Both of these coatings fall underneath the most restrictive limit. So the most restrictive limit would apply, and that would be the driveway seal, which is 50 grams per liter. The next is, suppose we have a situation where we have one that we have a coating which has two or more recommended uses. One of them, such as a concrete masonry sealer, which falls underneath the definition that falls underneath the most restrictive limit. And you have an industrial maintenance coating, which does not. Well, under the provision, because there are certain coatings that are exempt, and industrial maintenance coating would be exempt, it would be subject to the highest limit. Now, this is self-explanatory. I kind of mentioned the coating label requirements. This is the same as we currently have in our current regulation. All this is basically the same thing. Day code, you have to have a day code on the coating. I'll explain to you why this is important later on. VOC content, this is important. You have to state the VOC content of coatings and grams per liter. The second is thin recommendations. Most of the coatings do not need to be thin, but in case they need to be thin, the manufacturer, they can stay in the can, the maximum amount that the coating needs to be thin. We have labeling requirements for certain categories. This is the same as what we have in our current regulation. What it is that basically certain coatings on the can have to have a certain a label or a certain words. Let's say industrial maintenance coatings, it has to have the for industrial use only or for professional use. Rust preventive coatings, it has to be for metal substrates only. And for wood coatings, it has to be for wood substrates only. Now, I kind of mentioned the date code. This is where it's important because in order to know when for to know anything about this, you have to know when the coating was manufactured. And what it is it's written itself to the provision of loud, non-compliant coatings that were manufactured prior to the effective date to be sold, supplied, or offered for sale for 3 years, which means from January 1st, 2017 to January 1st, 2021. And let's suppose back when you had a coating which was, I mentioned before, flat coating was 100 grams per liter and changes underneath the current, under the proposed rules, to 50 grams per liter. Well, if it was made before January 1st, 2017, and have a date on that, you can prove it, that coating will be perfectly fine to use as of whenever you want to use after that date. And there are some additional requirements. Again, these are the same paint practices. All this is that whenever you use a paint, make sure it is the paint is closed, and as far as case of full reviews, then it must not exceed the applicable VOC limit. And code is not listed in the VOC content limits for any coatings. We have never come across any situation like that. Basically, what it says is that if you have a coating that doesn't fall in any of the definitions for any categories listed, what it will be is it will fall underneath the VOC content limit for either flat, or non-flat high glass gloss based on the corresponding gloss level. And that's about it, but I do want to add that we do also the same, we have compliance and reporting requirements for the regulation. And these are the same underneath our current rule, and we have other regulations, and other regulations also the handle Coleman requirements, so these are no different than what's in the proposed regulation. So, open the floor now to any questions. Yes,
Paul. Good job, Eddie. I had a question about your slide for most restrictive example number 2, which was the red paint.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why would this be subject, the 250 is the higher.
Yeah, I mentioned there are certain coatings laws that are not applied that don't apply to certain coating categories. Even though it's not listed here, this is an example. I don't want to list all of them because I'm going to swing your eyes, but industrial maintenance coatings is one of those coatings. You can see it there right there.
Okay.
It's one of those coatings there, so it would be, that provision does not apply to that.
Okay,
so if you have one, since it does not apply, you have industrial maintenance has a VOC level of 250 grams per liter. And you have another coating, which is concrete masonry seals, which would fall into the most restrictive limit. So it would apply since industrial maintenance coatings is exempt, that limit would be the higher limit that they could use.
Those exemptions are listed under 04C of the regulation.
Okay.
And there's certain categories.
I actually have several questions. Since we have a phase one, do we know how effective phase one was? Did we achieve the emissions reductions we wanted? Did they have an impact on ozone? Have we been able to ground truth any modeling that we did with phase one to know how effective phase two will be? And I guess one of my questions is, how is this going to affect ozone? Because that's what we're after. It's not just to reduce VOCs. The goal is to reduce ozone.
Yes, so that's a great question because our research tells us very clearly that our success over the past 15 years is to a certain extent been driven by NOx reductions. So the way I look at it, when you reduce regional NOx, you reduce regional ozone across a very broad region. There's no more debate or argument about that. There are, however, areas like the cities where the pollutant mix above the cities is such that VOC reductions do help. I don't think the VOC reductions do much to reduce ozone in Garrett County, Maryland, but they do help in a small way in areas like Baltimore and Washington and New York and in the Midwest. The South, one of the complicating factors of VOCs is that that as we've gotten smarter and smarter and smarter about the VOC part of our efforts, Ronald Reagan was sort of right. Our hydrocarbon inventory is driven by trees and crops. What, Diane, 60%, 70%, 80% of the hydrocarbons in our region are natural in nature. So that's another reason why the VOCs don't, they do help, but they're not our priority. In the South, we're not sure VOCs helps at all because of the way isoprene in the South just overwhelms the chemistry of creating ozone. So but we feel very strongly that these reductions do help. They help with toxics. The hidden secret is that reducing VOCs also helps us reduce fine particulate. Now, I don't think we can get into a dissertation today. Ross knows this better than anybody, but the role of hydrocarbons in terms of continuing to make progress on fine particulate is important. But it does help ozone. But it's a great question.
Okay, well, let me follow through with that.
Sure.
I assume that the same process that forms ozone also forms particulate.
That it needs to be
cooked a little bit in the sunlight is what I'm saying. So would it be better, would we have a more effective rule if we said, okay, don't paint from until 10 o'clock in the morning on emergency day, on code red days?
We have explored that. It is a very challenging.
Well, I was a painter for a number of years, and I can tell you, usually paint by 7 in the morning.
I understand that, but would it be better, because one of my questions is, how much does this increase the cost of paint?
Yeah, that's
and,
I want to
and would it be better, in here you say, in the facts, you say that it doesn't affect small businesses. But I know of a lot of painters that are small businesses. And not so much the architectural coatings like sealer, driveway sealers and stuff like that. Because, they could be small businesses too. But, could we get more bang for the buck and have a better impact on air pollution if we said, don't paint on code red days, or don't paint until noon on code red days, or something like that.
So your thought is a good one, but we have had very limited success. As a matter of fact, we've never gone down the path of mandating that kind of behavior. But what we do as part of our public education outreach effort, Clean Air Partners, we do routinely encourage folks for a whole host of activities, whether it's painting or refilling their vehicles, to think about when they do it. So we do that, but we don't mandate it in a rule. And I actually proposed that a long time ago. It was like our last action. We proposed a summer day restriction on the use of small boats. And it was not well received.
Yeah, that sounds like a winner.
It was a very crowded public hearing. So we do that, but we do it partially through our outreach education, cleaner
volunteer, more than
education. There are a lot of people who take that and do the right thing.
Do we know how much it increases the cost of a can of paint at Walmart or Home Depot or something?
Let me say, when we first version of this, when we put it in place, I guess you could say that we found out through compliance department that over the last 10 years since their regulations been in place, that more and more of these compliance codes have been the shelf. It's not really an issue. I think when the regulation first came to effect, that was an issue. It's not really now. Like I said, a lot of this now, because of formulation technology, you have more and more coatings that are being produced by manufacturers that are low VOCs, and they have good high, they have good durability. They're scuff resistant. They have all the problems that years ago that they came to us and they said, well, we don't like to make these type of coatings because of, we're concerned about this issue. It's not really an issue right now. It's not really an issue now.
But will it be an issue when we change over? I mean, for example, will we end up having to paint more often because the durability is not there yet?
No, like I said, I just mentioned durability. Durability is there.
I guess, just from personal experience, I guess I disagree. But, you know, for things like deck stains, okay. For example, I live in Washington County where I can go to West Virginia and buy stain that has distillates in it, you know, the older wood stain. You can't buy in Maryland, and I've used both of them. And the stuff that's, you know, sold in Maryland is just, it just doesn't work very well. And that's an example. And so I just wonder about this whole issue of durability and, you know, how long they really last in terms of you're not doing that activity, you know, instead of every 3 years, you're doing it every year.
Right.
And with paints, you know, I don't know, maybe more independent review, but I'm not sure that the paints now are as good in some ways that they were before. I guess that would depend on somebody's
expertise. I think it may depend on the different manufacturers. I'm not going to speak for one manufacturer or another. I think that there may be manufacturers out there that make a coating which is, and that has the properties that you're looking for, but there are some that, beyond the thing, they may not live up to your expectations.
I guess the thing that concerns me is from what, again, this is relatively new to me about the actual impact on ozone, that all this is being done when basically indicating that the effect is negligible. And
I would say at least for the paints, isn't it important on indoor air quality and whoever's sleeping in the room that's being painted or whatever?
Yeah, but
there are indoor air quality and toxics implications, but this has been an initiative that the Ozone Transport Commission has been working on for years, driven by ozone with co-benefits for those other pieces. And again, I mean, one of the difficult parts of this rule is that, that in all honesty, it should be a federal rule. And you'll probably hear from some of the manufacturers that's one of their concerns, is that they would prefer to have the single product be manufactured. So we did work with EPA on a federal rule, and it's very frustrating. We've had support from the manufacturers on a federal rule. So we are, a lot of us in the OTC are moving ahead. And I think Eddie had that up on his slide. At some point, the momentum shifts and the need for a federal rule sort of, you know, it's like what we did in Maryland with our Clean Cars program. We were one of the early movers on the Clean Cars program. It eventually got to the point where the market was mostly driven by states that had Clean Cars program. And then the manufacturers said, look, we just want to make a single product. And we ended up having the federal car program match the California. So this is a leadership initiative, and it is moving ahead. We work very hard with the manufacturers. A lot of the products that will be required in this regulation are already products that are being supplied to the market. This is the direction they appear to be moving in the market anyway. So, but it's us moving ahead a little faster than the rest of the country. Oh. Not just us. New York and some other states are doing the same thing.
Yeah. Can everybody hear me, including the people on the phone?
You can walk, if you want to walk over here, they'd be able to hear you better, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Thank you.
Eddie, Tad, thank you guys as well for, I just kind of wanted to come a little bit closer, for working on this rule, and I know you guys have done a lot of, based on like RCMA's recommendations for like adhesives and sealants, and we do appreciate that. Like Tad said, we have been working as long as the technology is there, like the manufacturers are more than willing to help. So with us, it's a lot about feasibility. The only thing I did want to ask about that we kind of like discussed in April was like the early compliance option or perhaps provision. As the rule is amended right now, a lot of the kind of like the niche categories that we kind of talked about, like tub and tile, that kind of stuff, it will not go into effect until January 2017. Some of the manufacturers are a little worried that they won't be able, they can't sell these products until January 1st, 2017, even though they comply with the VOC limits. So is there kind of like talks or discussion about?
We've had discussions with our Attorney General's office, and they didn't feel that that was necessary, but they wanted to go ahead and sell it. So, I mean, that's something that if you want to bring up and address again, you can take another look at it. But there's their preliminary feeling about it before the upcoming second discussion.
First of all, I apologize. Who are you and who do you represent?
Sure. So I'm Chelsea Ritchie, and I handle the legislative and regulatory affairs for the Roof Coaters Manufacturers Association.
Okay.
So a lot of the products that we do have reflective roof coatings, which kind of like help urban heat island effect and a lot of other environmental benefits.
White coatings,
reflective coatings, yeah.
Can you tell me how much, what's the difference in cost for a gallon of coating?
Mm-hmm.
Under phase one and phase two?
It depends per manufacturer, but I will say that a lot of the manufacturers essentially go to the reformulators, and like I said, if the technology is there, they're more than willing to do it, and they've kind of been doing it, to be honest with you. What they were talking about with what you've seen with like the EPA versus what's going on in California, a lot of these manufacturers are national, even though we do represent a lot of small businesses, they are trying to make one product and have it distributed throughout. In terms of like working with California and Maryland and the EPA, that's kind of why you're seeing it's been more longer over time. It's not been like millions of dollars.
What is your resistance then to going ahead and just doing the new ones, the new formulation as opposed to the old one?
No resistance. I mean, we've been working with them. There's been like an ongoing process. We just try to, on our sense, just provide information and say, okay, great, we're working on lowering the standard, but can we do this in a feasible manner so that the manufacturers are able to really kind of, and that's where you see the sell-through provisions, get the old product out, get the new one on the shelves. Can we do this in a way that it's economically feasible?
And that was one of the big things we had worked with stakeholders early on to set the effective date of January 1, 2017.
Can you say anything about the durability of these newer materials compared to the older ones?
That's something that we're constantly kind of struggling with as well. And so I definitely hear where you're coming from in that. One of the issues that, and this is why you're seeing the small container, when he's talking about not bundling and one of the issues that we're finding, particularly with California, is that people are just going out of state and buying the products and then coming back in. So as manufacturers, we're working with the regulators and the agencies to say, okay, how do we make sure that our product is giving the consumers what they want, but also being a lower VOC product. So it is an ongoing
process. See, I'm a big believer in people voting with their feet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I question, are we ending up having to recoat more often, and that results in a net increase in overall VOCs, particularly on the toxic side, where the older coatings might last longer, and so they don't need to be reapplied as frequently. And you know, I understand that we're down, when you're talking about 6% reduction, that's total VOCs, not just paint VOCs, not just coating VOCs. But I know that we're reaching up here at the where the curve is bending over, and we have to spend more and more to get less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure that what we're doing is effective in controlling ozone and fine particulates. That's the end result.
From my perspective, I think we will. And I think issues like durability are issues that the private sector is working very hard. You know, sometimes the intensity of the stakeholder process doesn't come through in these ACAC meetings, but we've been working with this industry for the past, 15 years. And so we have discussions about niche products and durability, and so we are seeing a slow, continuous improvement process. And I do think that if not happening now in the very near future, the issues like durability will be things that are no longer an issue. So
have frequently been technology forced.
Yeah.
And so, but I also think in this case that we have a phase one that
sort of a ground truth to say, okay, have we achieved the same durability at the end of phase one that we have before phase one? And is there a net reduction? And I'm still curious.
Can you all hear me?
Environmental benefit, and I think that what sort of has come across, but maybe I need to hammer it, is that we've been working very closely with the manufacturers, and even though we continue to have areas we need to keep working on, there's general support for where we're trying to go, with probably the one criticism being that they would much prefer this to be a federal requirement, and that it creates that single product kind of concept. So,
back to that point for a minute, Ted. We use the clean car initiative as an analogy. Of course, the pollutant profile for that is much broader and different than it is here. Do you feel it's a foregone conclusion that there'll be a national coding standard at some point, even though the benefit in certain areas like in the Southeast is not so great or not even discernible?
I do. I think at some point, there will be enough momentum that will end up in a federal program. There are even discussions going on with EPA right now over a non-traditional approach, since the manufacturers appear to be moving in this direction in many cases anyway. Is there some kind of a self-certification concept? But EPA is stretched very thin, and they basically told us that this is on our list, but we haven't gotten to it. We're working on other things. So. But I do think at some point you will see something.
I heard there was somebody on the phone wanted to speak.
Yeah, it's Larry's here. Sorry I can't be there with you in person.
Hi, Larry.
Hi. I just, you know, this is not authoritative, but I just did a little bit of web search. And facilitiesnet.com, which is directed towards facilities managers, they quote a couple of paint executives. One is PPG's Pittsburgh Paints Division, and Tony Jager, he says 10 to 15 years ago, I'm going to skip some words, they were difficult to apply and wouldn't hide and they wouldn't stand up. But then he says that these days, as there are more programs, the paint industry is slowly being driven to develop more environmentally responsible products that also meet facility executives' stringent performance standards. Another quote says, advances in paint technology have allowed the creation of formulas that reduce or eliminate VOX without reducing the durability of the products. That's from Steve Renview, Director of Marketing for Sherwin-Williams. I mean, I'm not a paint chemist, but intuitively, the volatiles to me are the carrier that allows you to put the coating on. And they go away, they don't remain. So it just, I may be wrong, but intuitively it seems to matter more that you have enough carrier to be able to spread it, and that the durability comes from the substrate, from what remains behind on the substrate. That's just my own non-paint expert sort of intuitive understanding.
Hi, this is Dave Darling with American Coatings Association. I was wondering if I can jump in real quick.
Please do.
Okay. Well, we appreciate, of course there could be, drawbacks of new technology, but, we were able to work with the OTC and staff over a number of years. Several of the standards in this rule are higher than, say, California. You know, we're able to go in and especially show staff and OTC that, we needed a little bit higher, VOC content. So a lot of those negotiations occurred, and we're appreciative of OTC and staff. I wanted to mention what Chelsea had mentioned earlier, that this early compliance provision that we're talking about, as the limits lowered, there are a couple niche categories that were created, and instead of manufacturers having to use a small container exemption, if Maryland could provide this little short new category provision, manufacturers could more easily comply with this rule with larger containers. It would help with the burden. If you have any other questions, I would be happy to answer.
Thank you.
I don't understand what that means.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
About the new category provision, yes. So there were several categories that were lowered in VOC content. However, through negotiations, we were able to, there's a couple niche categories. For example, the tub and tile that was mentioned earlier. They needed actually, when the industrial maintenance was lowered, but there's a very, very niche category, tub and tile, that you might put into your bathroom, that actually went up in VOC content. If the compliance date is 1/1/2017, if a manufacturer wanted to, sell those products right now, before the compliance date, they'd have to use a small container exemption, one liter. If this new provision that was, was in the OTC model rule was enacted, then the manufacturer could use, a gallon, could comply with the new limit without having to use a small container exemption. I apologize for being, it's a detail, a lot of complex detail, but it would help with the burden aspects of this rule.
Okay, maybe just to see if I understand. So the new limit is actually less restrictive than the old limit. And so that's why
Correct. Another way to look at it is if a manufacturer, the date of the compliance is 1/1/2017. And if right now a manufacturer wanted to meet the higher limit, which is in the new rule, in theory, it could be an enforcement situation. If they had a one-gallon container out there, enforcement could say, "Well, you're not complying with the current rule, even though we're trying to comply with the future." So that's why we're asking for this new category provision. It will give us essentially until 1/1/2017. It will allow the manufacturers to comply with the new standards that will come into play at that time.
So if we can follow this point, maybe with Eddie, what number goes up?
Talking about tub and tile or reactive?
For example, tub and tile goes up to 420. There's like four categories that actually go up slightly, while the major categories go down.
Okay, so tub and tile is one. Okay.
And maybe if I take
another is conjug. Sure.
If this is John Quinn, so the rule is here. MD worked with the affected parties to resolve, and this one, there's a glitch that the timing doesn't allow certain adoptions. So maybe I'll just go to Tad. Is that something we can work with on this subset of categories?
I think we can. I think I don't actually view this as a subset change. We just need to work it through the rule. We have to make that change.
Well, sorry. I'd like to, just for the record, I'd like to go through which numbers are rising and what the old number was. So the first one is tub and tile. It's now being proposed to go to 420. What had it been at?
I believe that's a new category.
Okay, so there wasn't. Okay. And
well, actually, it was industrial maintenance, which was went down. So these little niche categories were covered by a bigger category that actually went down in DOC.
Okay, so industrial maintenance coatings is now at 250 grams per liter. And did that go up? Or what is it today right now?
I believe it's
340.
Okay, so that goes down. But you had mentioned that there's some that are going up.
I think what happened is, it was a blanket category called industrial coatings. Now, that has gone down, but they've broken out a new category called tub and tile, which has actually gone up.
Right, got it.
That's okay. What I think.
Which is a much smaller category, very, very niche, compared to the huge category. So the huge category goes down, but a very, very small niche actually went up.
Okay, so one of them is the tub and tile refinishing. Another one was the conjugated oil varnish. Is that
correct.
Right? And what are the other two?
There's two. It's a reactive penetrating sealer, reactive penetrating carbonate stone sealer. Those are used for like historic preservation.
Okay, great. And what's the other one?
I think those were the four that I could think of right now.
Great. Okay, and those numbers, certainly those aren't the highest numbers on our list. Like,
no, in a very retarded. In a very small volume compared to the, you know, the major categories.
Okay, and these numbers are all from OTC, right? This is all the Ozone Transport Commission states have agreed to these numbers?
Yes, the OTC has worked on this enhanced AIM rule. Now, we also work very closely with California. So not everything in California works the same way that it in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, but we do work very closely with California as well.
Just one more. The new provision language is actually in the OTC model rule, so it's been out there for a couple of years.
Yeah. And we were just suggesting that was just taken from the OTC model rule and applied to Maryland.
So Eddie, the department's done a before and after mass balance based on the changes in categories, the change in the VOC content, and the relative volume of those niche categories to come up with a net reduction. Is that right? Is that correct?
How many tons a day?
So I think I'm
estimating 2.6 tons. Okay,
so I think I'm following all of this, that the manufacturers are comfortable with this. They just want to be able to sell these products sooner than 2017, if they're going to go to the trouble of making this, they want them on the shelf.
We can sit down and do some work with that on that information.
Yeah, and Eddie, you said that something about the Attorney General or something that you thought this.
I think it was a missing review.
He felt that it was just since the category wasn't defined until January 1, 2017, there's no restriction on it until that point, so we felt that it could be sold in the state of Maryland without
the But we presently have restrictions.
Enumerated, yes. But not for that category.
Because it's a new category, the break.
But it fell under an old category.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, so you think they will be able to sell the product, the bottom line?
That was the discussion, but we're discussing now to just modify the rule.
There's just nothing to cite. Yeah, so if somebody tries to
force
it.
I see this as a clarification of error, and that was the way the process has worked is we've gone from discussions of broad categories to let's move ahead with the benefits for the broad categories, but there are sort of niche products that we have to handle in a special way, and so that's what this is all about. I think we can work this out with some language in the rule, non-substantive, clearly the intent. We still get the overarching VOC reductions, but give the manufacturers the assurances they want about being able to sell the products and not get into a compliance situation, we probably need to make it real clear.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. So let's focus on that. And how do you have just a higher level sense of what that language would look like?
Well, I'd just like to bring up another point and aspect of this regulation is that the effective date isn't until January 1, 2017, so whatever happens between now and then that we put in the regulation doesn't really apply. So, you know, it, we're not really gaining anything.
So
it's an enforcement discretion.
Yeah, but what you heard from the affected people, they would prefer to have some certainty. So is there any way to add language to the rule that gives them that certainty? Like something, please, I don't know this subject at all, does not preclude the use of product up to the effective date of January 1st, 2017.
I'm thinking the one way we could go around that is to add potentially an effective date for the provision as when the rule will become
for certain categories. We could clarify that these categories can be implemented from the date the regulation becomes effective,
but then
whereas
the
others
the reg takes effect January 1, 2017.
You made a suggestion actually, and just kind of came together and said, how about an early compliance provision just saying anything mentioned in table 1A that is complied prior to January 1st, 2017 is accepted, and we just made it general,
and just gave it in our comments suggestion. I know David also put that as well. Just to say anything also, just not necessarily just the niche ones, but if you have manufacturers that have low VOC products, you know, go ahead and anything prior to January 1st, 2017 that's being sold, which is fine. So that was our suggestion.
And so is there any air quality impact, negative air quality impact of that?
No.
Is that something you think? I know you probably have to go through a longer process, but does that feel right, that suggestion? Why, if they made it, why you didn't grab it before? I just want to, we're too far away from it to know these nuances.
Well, you can just add, at the latest, you comply by January 1, 2017. So that is the deadline. But if you can comply earlier, it's fine too.
Well, the OTC language says something like that. I think yours was an alteration upon that, which was suggested before, that we're discussing maybe integrating that type of a language. It's the intention of the rule. We weren't trying to preclude or prevent. It was just a decision from our Attorney General's office that it wasn't necessary from a compliance perspective, but it just provides comfort and clarity.
Will you state that so we get it in the minutes, what your recommendation was?
Sure. To add to the proposed rule, all categories in Table 1 for the lower VOC limits to have, if these categories were met prior to January 1st, 2017, that would be accepted. I think we have specific language that we sent, but
you don't have to get it exactly right now. But I just want to make sure we got it in the minutes clear.
Of course.
Then you got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
So is that acceptable to the department?
Also, my name is Chelsea with RCMA, in case anybody has the minutes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chelsea.
Anybody have any questions or comments on that suggestion, in which the department seems to be okay with? Anybody on the phone have a comment or question? So
we just appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
I think it's a good precedent.
This is Pat Giesky from Valspar. I do have a quick comment. We are in agreement with you and your position versus EPA. One of the issues that we have with EPA is their inability to lower the national standard. One of the things that we do see is that the individual air districts or states that are impacted with EPA not regulating or lowering those limits will have an impact on the state implementation plans. And OTC and other air districts continue to try to push EPA to lower their limit so they don't have to take actions for their SIPs. So we do appreciate your viewpoint. One of the other things that we want to say is that as a national company, what we tend to do is we are not making two piles of products, one for California and one for the rest of the United States. A lot of the products that we are putting into Maryland are the same products that are being sold into California. There are a lot of zero VOC products for the interior products and lower limit products for exterior products. But there are some specialty categories, as we have talked about, similar to the tub and tile, the stain category, where there are higher VOCs that are needed to actually make these products perform. But one of the things that we have done with your state through the American Coatings Association is to talk about these things so you have a better understanding of our viewpoint of what actually does work and what doesn't work and where we can make these changes. So as far as these changes go, these are, I guess, pretty status quo from what we see. So I do appreciate your time and effort in making these limits.
Are you saying basically that, I mean, we had mentioned the thing about, you know, stains, for example. I'll give you another example. I'm a forester and work with a lot of foresters. You do a lot of tree marking out in the woods. Well, the paint yep. you get anymore barely lasts a year, you know. It used to last 3-4 years. And, you know, when you walk around for days marking trees, the last thing you want to do is go back and mark them again. And so like I said, here you're saying there are these specialty categories which right now have to meet these lower limits, but the products don't perform. So is there some...
In some cases, that's true, where they don't perform as well because they do have some lower limits, but there's, you know, it's a balance. You know, we fight for those categories where we believe that the higher VOC is needed, especially from a performance standpoint, and we also agree with that, is you need to look at performance versus, you know, lifetime. If I have to coat a product 3 times, but it only has a slightly lower VOC, why would I want to have a lower VOC if I've got to put 3 times as much VOC into the atmosphere over a certain period of time versus just doing it once? So we agree on the performance issue. It's just a matter of which categories they are and what we can work with.
So are you saying that some of the categories that are set up now are not, perhaps don't have those limits, so you're not going to get that performance? Some of these
In some cases, you won't get as good of a performance, correct.
So is there the likelihood of going, is that a likely negotiation where some of those things could be changed under this regulation, or with this regulatory change, those things are written in stone?
Once these go into effect, I mean, for the most part, that's what they're going to be. Are we okay with where they're at? From a company standpoint, we would say yes. From an industry standpoint, it depends on the company who's making products, because there are local companies, regional companies that don't make product for California or some of these other air districts that have higher VOCs. One of the things that they will have to do is to go back to meet these regulations, is to reformulate those products, which does take time and effort on their parts. So you may have some impact on smaller businesses, especially regionals.
And just to reiterate what you said, Tad, that a lot of these box on a lot of the states in warmer climates, that the benefits are negligible. So, I mean, there's 19, 17 states, and what you're pressing for is a federal rule, which is going to impose those on all the states where those VOX requirements may be, you know, the benefits are negligible in some of those areas, categories. Is that what I understand?
I also just want to sort of remind the group about these co-benefits that were mentioned earlier. Not all VOCs are created equal in terms of their toxicity and harm that they do for human lungs, for example. So a lot of VOCs, right. Like the smell of baking bread, is fortunately not toxic. And so a lot of the VOCs that are emitted from forests and plants do contribute to ozone, but they're not particularly toxic or harmful for lungs, whereas these industrial chemicals, those VOCs tend to have more toxicity and more harm. And so I think that we should sort of just keep in mind these health co-benefits of improving the air quality overall for people breathing indoors and outdoors, as well as the idea that, you know, as a state that has done a good job of taking leadership in some of these issues, we can actually push the national standard as well.
Oh, I agree with you. And one of the things you are going to find that, you know, if you look at the two biggest categories are the flat coatings and non-flat coatings, where your non-flat category has a 100 gram per liter limit, there are a lot, most of the larger companies are providing products that are at 50 grams per liter or less. And as far as Valspar is, we make a myriad of products that are zero VOC that meet those limits. And that is probably the major volume contributors to VOC. So as we lower our VOC product in California, the state of Maryland and OTC states will also see those benefits because those products are being sold nationally.
Thank you. I'm just going to go to Dr. Salowitz here.
Yeah. Since we're going around the table sharing anecdotes, I'll share mine. I want to just begin my anecdote sharing by saying that indoor air pollution is termed the silent killer. It is very important for public health, and it's very difficult to get after because what do? You have to go in people's homes and measure air in people's homes. It's the silent killer. My anecdote is the paints have come a tremendous way. I recently purchased a home in northwest Baltimore for my family, nieces and nephews to move in. We have several people with asthma in the home. We did a repaint. We're stunned at both the performance and the fact that we didn't even have to open windows. It's like a new world. In the old days, the house is uninhabitable with people with asthma. For days after painting, this house was habitable the day of. So congratulations. My anecdote is purely positive because we're going after the silent killer.
I think the rules on the table, there's been some attempt to address the stumbling block, and MDEs agreed to make a change to make it clear that early attainment doesn't define non-compliance. So my suggestion is we discuss, or I'd like to have a motion to pass, and then we'll have a bit of discussion on whether to pass the rule with the minor modification, non-substantive change that's been suggested by Connect.
So moved.
Second.
All right, I'm just going to allow the bill discussion.
No, I just want to make a comment.
You please do.
I think happened several, couple sessions ago when we talked about the ozone and the NOx. People forgot that NOx and VOCs are toxic. Beside the fact that they are precursor for ozone, we're always thinking about ozone, so it doesn't contribute anything to ozone, so it's okay. No, it's not okay, because they are toxic by themselves. And that may be more toxic beside the respiratory, there is the neurosystem too. So that's why we always talk about ozone, but that's the end point. That they are by themselves very toxic. And I would refer to Ross anecdote, because I bought the paint myself. It was very low VOC indeed, and interestingly enough, the painter did not understand that he did not need a second coat. I said no. I paid a little bit more than the regular paint, but it was very low VOC, no second coat, and we were able to be in the house all the time. So that's really something very important.
Let me just qualify my statement. I just been painting the last 2 days, and I agree. And I was a house painter as I got me away from college. And I totally agree. My thing isn't so much with paints, because that makes perfect sense. I guess my concern is with some of the more, maybe industrial applications or unique applications where either homeowners or, maintenance workers spend a lot of time and labor to apply something, and if the product doesn't perform, I just would hope that there's flexibility here to change that. And I guess what I hear you saying as well, the industry is going to adapt and the technology is going to come. Well, maybe, I'm not necessarily hearing that. So I guess what you said is basically once these are set in stone, that's it. And then it's up to industry to develop something that's going to be durable, I guess. But that's just my concern. And again, having having worked just my forestry example and other things where a lot of time and effort is spent. And then, so that's my concern, not so much with paint, things like that, but with these kind of unique applications.
And if we had seven companies in here challenging the rule saying this is impossible, and if we had seven users saying we need the product that they used to deliver, I would tend to agree with you, but there's been a stakeholder process, and I'm not hearing that. And that's where I come out on this.
It's just a follow-up to what Jonathan said. So, I mean, presumably, well, not presumably, if a national standard were to come out and it were different than this, what would we do? I mean, we'd comply with the national standard, right?
Most restrictive would apply.
Most restrictive. Okay.
If it were stricter, we would definitely apply. Whether if our rule is more aggressive, then we'd have to work through that.
But there is no national standard right now.
Well, there is, but it's not. There's been multiple phases of paint rules, so there are federal rules out there.
Oh, there are. Okay.
But this is some of the states that need to continue to make progress, protect the environment, whether it's ozone or toxics, moving forward to try to. And working very closely with the industry to try to make progress. That's really what this is.
And the interior applications seem to be the big thing with regards to, like you said, the benefits from asthma and other things. So it's more the exterior things where there seems to be more flexibility in terms of if the products, you know, could be stronger in some way or another. But I guess that's not what they are.
But you've heard the term niche product come up at least four or five times. So a lot of the discussion has been about how to make sure that those products who perhaps need the higher VOC limit to make sure that's part of this model rule. And that's the comment we got about making sure that you can move forward and sell those products more quickly is consistent. But we've talked more about niche products over the past 5 years than anybody would ever want to do.
Well, when they develop the paint that lasts 3 years, 4 years on the trees, I'm sold.
As long as it's not toxic to the trees.
If it's ever toxic to the trees.
So we have a motion and a second on the table. Any more discussion? To be clear, the motion and the second were on the rule as drafted with an addition to make it clear that early compliance, early adoption is meets a compliance standard. All in favor? Any opposed? Abstain?
This is Lita. I'm voting in favor.
Thank you.
I'm just going to abstain just for.
It's fine. Larry?
And Larry's a yes.
Thank you. Anybody else that we missed or joined late?
I believe Larry is yes. Yeah. Or was this Larry Show?
He's yes.
He's Larry Show.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Is Lawrence Case Camp on?
You on mute?
Yes.
Do you have a vote?
I got it now.
Are you talking to me?
No, Mr. Casecamp.
Yes, I'd like to abstain.
Thank you. All right, thanks. Just giving you a time check. We have 15 minutes left, and we have two more rules to go through. Tad, could you give us an idea of how much time we think we need for these?
Well, the Clean Air Interstate rule is really a regulatory cleanup because of a lot of things happening with the courts and the federal Clean Air Interstate rule now being replaced by the Cross State. So it's a little complicated, but it is a cleanup. It's not a terribly substantive rule. And as well with the iron and steel installation, it's also a cleanup. With two briefings, we can push to a future ACAC meeting.
So do you need a Clean Air Interstate rule? Do you need the iron and steel production rule vote today? All right, so do you think we can get them both done in 15 minutes?
Iron and steel will take 1 minute.
Okay, let's do iron and steel first, then be success.
Okay.
Then we
can... Oh, I didn't mean to.
Go ahead.
I don't know. It's so quick, I don't even have a presentation. But the iron and steel regulation is basically a further, the final removal of our technical memorandum 9001, which basically establishes procedures for operating a continuous emission monitor, as well as some quality assurance practices. Everything that was in this technical memorandum that has been adopted as part of the department's process for how to handle these monitoring instruments have been codified into COMAR 2611-01-11, which is our CEM procedures, as well as the quality assurance chapter we had written for 2611-31. So we don't need the reference to this old paper document anymore. This was in our iron and steel regulation. It was the last vestige of it. We've been doing this for since 2007. It's a very simple regulatory change that just points you to the CEF procedure in 2611-01-11 instead of the whole paper document.
So all references to technical memorandum 9001 will be removed, and in its place a reference to the appropriate COMAR place. It's rather simple. Are people comfortable with making a motion? We can have further discussion. Anybody comfortable making a motion to pass? There's a motion, there's a second, and it doesn't matter who did. All you have to do is say that the motion occurred and the second occurred. Any further discussion, we'll take as much time as we need. This is about how monitors operate, and TM9001 means 1990 it was written. So still was required for some archaic processes. Now they have the more modern processes to refer to, deeper, more comprehensive.
And there's no iron and steel in the state anymore, right?
That's another issue. There's no effect. We're leaving that chapter in place for the time being.
But the guy that wrote the original TM was a very smart guy.
That was you.
That's what I was pointing at. Sorry, yes. To get rid of your work.
Yes, that's it.
It's seen its day.
My
that's
only
success
got
to air pollution, is it?
That's right. So we have a motion and we have a second. All in favor of the change? Any opposed? Larry, and Lita.
I'm in favor.
Larry's a yes.
Okay, I got all three. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to the clean air interstate rule.
Okay, we'll go through this.
Another way to title this is the final performance.
Yeah, so just real quick, since Diane
sounds like a rock concert.
Back Act meeting, Diane has been sort of at the heart of our progress here at the moment, so it's going to be hard to see her move on. But a lot of the success we've had over the years is driven by Diane's good work. So one last chance.
Well, the secret to success is really good staff, and Randy's done a great job, and you see my staff here every ACAC meeting, and they do a lot of the behind-the-scenes work, so they're really good.
Clean Air Act, Section 126, prohibits the interstate transport of pollution if it makes a significant contribution to the ability of another state to achieve compliance with any of the federal clean air standards. And EPA over the years has developed a few regulations to help us out in controlling the interstate transport. The first one was the NOx SIP call. The second one was the Clean Air Interstate Rule. And now there is yet another one, the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule. These were all developed as cap and trade rules. CARE was important because CARE was to address both the fine particulate standard and the ozone standard, and it addressed NOx and SOx both. The colored states are the ones where CARE applied. There was unrestricted trading in CARE, and when you have unrestricted trading, sometimes you don't get any improvement in a particular geographic area because those sources are the ones that will be buying the allowances instead of doing the controls. And there was a lot of litigation over CARE because of that, and it ended up being superseded by the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule. Now, sandwiched in the middle of the transport rules here, we have a little blurb about the Healthy Air Act, and we put that in there because we recognized
the shortfalls of care, and we passed the Healthy Air Act, and it doesn't allow training to meet the standards that it has, the caps that are on the EGUs. CARE was proposed in 2004, and it took 3 years to get it final. And as soon as it was final, the litigation started. We were able to adopt our version of the Clean Air Interstate Rule in 2007, the same year that the federal was adopted, and it included both annual and seasonal NOx and annual SO2 trading programs. Now, the transport rule, the cross-state air pollution rule, is going to take the place of CARE. It's off, the cross-state air pollution rule is often called CAFR, and it also addresses PM2.5 and ozone through the control of SO2 and NOx. It's had some litigation difficulties, and it has now become effective January the 1st, but there's still litigation, and even litigation against the Maryland budgets that were described in the CASPER rule. So it's still, because it's in effect, we can remove CARE from our regulations. And one of the difficult parts of doing this type of thing, removing CARE, is that it has gotten into a lot of different rules besides just the CARE rule. So 261128 is the CARE cross-state interstate rule, the Clean Air Interstate Rule, sorry, too many acronyms, is 261128, and that rule is being repealed in its entirety, and it will be replaced federally by the cross-state air pollution rule. We have not taken delegation of a cross-state air pollution rule because it's still under litigation, but it's fully effective even though we haven't actually done a state rule here in Maryland. We also had some NOx allowances that were allowed to be used as alternative compliance payments, and that definition of NOx ozone season allowance
head southeast on South Monroe Street toward Washington Boulevard
to CARE.
Sorry.
And so we needed to change the reference of CARE to the cross-state air pollution rule, and that is 261101B24-1. The third rule we're amending is to remove, it's 261114-07C1, and that is referring to the Kraft pulp mill, and it removes a reference to CARE in that regulation. And that source was not a trading source any longer, so it doesn't need to be replaced with anything. It just has the CARE reference come out. We're also going to amend 261114-07D1A. This is a semantics request by EPA. We use the word certified in the definition, but you don't really need certified. So they ask us to remove it, and we're removing just that word. So that's everything.
That's the best damn briefing I've ever heard.
Thank you.
That's why I will miss her.
I don't think we are allowed, do we?
I think they've been working on that. Questions for Ms. Frank? I entertain a motion.
Sorry, I have a question. So will CASPER not be referred to in the state regulations now?
No, there aren't any references to CASPER.
Because it's a federal regulation.
There were all those letters up there. So it's coded under the federal Code of Federal Regulations, but in the Code of Federal Regulations, they don't even call it the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule. That was just sort of an acronym that folks gave it. Yeah. See, it's all it all, it's only 40 CFR 97 subparts. Quintuple A, quintuple B, and quintuple C.
Just to put us in context, because basically what this is meant to do is to deal with pollution that's, you know, from like maybe other power plants or something.
Power plants, yes.
From coming in from other states.
Exclusively.
That's basically what this is all about, right?
Yes, it is.
And the background is that there's been unbelievable amount of litigation over the federal rules. And EPA started, stopped, there were stays. The industry said, please don't stay it because we've invested a lot of. So it's been a real mess in terms of the litigation. This is just cleaning it all up.
Probably we cleaned it out.
Second. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
And the phone?
Yes.
Larry's in favor.
Yeah.
Larry Schoen is in favor.
Lita, I said yes.
Okay, we have Lita and Larry Schoen, and Larry Casecamp is your vote?
This is Lita, yes.
I think all three, I'm having a vote yes. So.
Thank you. Any opposed? Any abstains? Good. Thank you. Do you have any final comments, Stan?
No. We appreciate the actions today. Are you thinking about maybe holding off on the briefings?
Yes, we're at 10:15, and that's what time our agenda goes to. I suggest we do that, but I was going to let the council agree with that or disagree. We have the presentations, and we can move them to the next meeting, and then everyone can
get How out long are they?
How long are they?
The stage two is really just a very quick update. The second one's actually a little bit longer, but it's probably the most important thing we're working on in terms of continuing to make progress on ozone, but it is longer. One of the options would be that we have now invested in webinar capabilities, and if ACAC ever wanted to have a briefing in the form of a webinar, we could certainly arrange that. So this one's actually quite good. It's quite interesting, but it will take at least a half an hour, maybe.
I move that we try the webinar.
It's a good thing for briefings.
Yeah.
I do a lot of webinars for my.
I think it's a great idea. Because I have another CPAC meeting to go to.
Well, I know you do. Well, yeah.
45 minutes ago.
Is that something we should try to arrange? I still think there's value in at least having a short reminder of those presentations at the next meeting, if there's time. Because you know how webinars are, and even if I do one, sometimes you're distracted.
No.
Right. When I'm here, I don't have the clear, concise mind, focused mind you have. I think we should at least bring them back, and it does. I hope it doesn't disappoint you.
Not at all.
Any other thoughts from people in the audience?
Just saying the instruction.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everyone. The meeting's adjourned.
Thank you all.
Excuse me, I need to interrupt real quick. Can I open your phone? No, I don't.